let me school you on public schools.
Yeah, but
in England, a public school is a private school. It's reversed. Like over there, when they talk about public school types, they're talking about rich kids who go to private elite.
So would you say, so maybe just to, because I didn't know that. So consider me school.
All right, everyone, welcome back to Presenting Alfred Hitchcock
with episode 4 from 1927, where we will be watching Downhill, Alfred Hitchcock's fourth movie. Downhill was originally released in the United States as When Boys Leave Home, but nobody calls it that anymore, so we will never refer to it again this episode.
I am one of your hosts, Kenny. With me, as always, is Sam and Lance. This week, also with us, is Ivor Novello, our good friend from The Lodger, also starring in this movie. We're going to give you a quick spoiler-free synopsis. So, Sam, why don't you take it away in case someone hasn't watched it and wants to stop the video and go run and see it.
And kind of naive... English, in the English sense, a public school.
All right, yeah. So Downhill is the story of Roddy Bowick.
He is sent into exile when his life metaphorically goes swiftly downhill until he, I don't know. I guess you'll just have to watch and find out what happens to Roddy Bowick. But he's set on all this misfortunes because of his kind of his good nature. It's a big element of the movie. And that's about as synopsis as I want, as into the synopsis as I want to get. I want to leave some
breathing room.
Three. Yeah.
No, have you ever heard of this movie?
No.
Nope. No. Until looking into the Silent Hitchcock, I had no idea about this movie. And I actually thought, because I was flipping through the Taschen Hitchcock book, there was a shot from The Mountain Eagle, and it was like the movie takes place in, I think it's the Austrian Alps. I had seen a production still, or like a behind the scenes still, and this guy in the mountains, and I assumed that Downhill had something to do with skiing. So that's about as much as I knew about the movie. I had mistaken a photo.
I think I did the exact same thing. I think I was thumbing through the book. And I saw Downhill, and I saw that, and I thought, oh, a skiing movie. That sounds exciting.
According to BrentonFilm.com, there are two versions of Downhill, 4 transfer speeds, and 5 scores. For this film, we have really good options because Criterion released the tinted BFI restoration as a bonus on the Lodger Blu-ray and DVD. That version is also available on Criterion Channel, the app, which I highly recommend. So what about you guys? What versions did you end up falling on?
So I started with the T-Bone Classic Media version. I kind of scrubbed through the timelines of a bunch of different versions that were available on YouTube. This one was, to my mind, the most watchable, but it is not tinted. It is just black and white. It was a really nice print. And the soundtrack is piano music that I would say is appropriate for the era.
Yeah, the soundtrack for the Criterion one was done by Neil Brand, who also did the Lodger soundtrack. They got the same guy. And I thought zero problems with the soundtrack. I thought it worked great with the film. I feel like if the soundtrack is doing its job, I'm probably not sitting there critiquing it. So good job, Neil Brand.
All right. Well, I watched the BFI restoration version that's on YouTube, and at some point YouTube took the audio off of it, I think. This is what I've been able to try to figure out from the comments, because a lot of people were saying, where did the sound go? And so I don't know if I've actually technically watched this movie yet, because I've I saw it as a truly silent film with no score. So nothing was telling me how to feel, and no music was telling me what I should think about the scene. So I just kind of settled.
That feels sad.
That's all I got to say about that.
All right. This movie was based on a play that was co-written by Ivor Novello and a woman called Constance Collier, who was an English stage and film actress and a friend of Novello's. The title screen of the movie mentions David LeStrange after the title Downhill. So I did a little bit of digging on that and discovered that that's actually the combined pen name for Ivor Novello and Constance Collier, which was most likely in honor of a mutual friend and actor of theirs, Julian LeStrange, who had been married to Constance and who had died suddenly of influenza during the 1918 pandemic. So Novello ran with kind of a tight crew, and they're very well represented with this movie. She, Constance Collier, actually does make a cameo appearance. I saw on IMDb as Dance Hall Lady with Purse. I don't remember her. I'll try to find her and throw an image up over here somewhere. But Elliot Stannard is credited as writing the scenario.
Did we ever figure out if that's Stannard or Stannard?
He did the scenario for most of these early Hitchcock movies, where he would take the play, book, or whatever it was and adapt it for a silent picture. So it's weird because Hitchcock seemed to not like this movie from what I've seen from his talks with Truffaut. He called it a rather poor play. This is the quote. "It was a rather poor play. As it happens, it was written by Ivor Novello." I feel like this movie maybe wasn't entirely a movie Hitchcock wanted to do, kind of one maybe he was assigned to do, maybe because of Ivor Novello's influence as the writer and star. He didn't have, or maybe he didn't even want, a complete control over this project.
Certainly doesn't. It doesn't bear the obvious stamp of Hitchcock the way that I think some of the other movies did.
There's a really great line on the Criterion. Peter Bogdanovich does an interview with Hitchcock, and there's a really great line about Downhill where Hitchcock says something along the lines of, "Did you know that Ivor Novello was a 30-year-old man and he was supposed to be playing a schoolboy?" Like, and it's that's a horrible Hitchcock impersonation. But the fact that you're talking about the lead actor in your movie.
Well, it was ridiculous, and it is ridiculous in the movie, and we'll continue discussing that. But certainly, it was certainly one of the things that popped up in my mind. Like, how old are these people supposed to be? Because they don't look, 17. 16.
That's just a problem in films in general, and television especially. You're always seeing like the 30-year-old high school student. It's like Luke Perry in 90210. I thought the cast was interesting. This movie to me, I'm glad to hear that Alfred Hitchcock hated it, because I didn't have a very high opinion of this movie. I didn't read the Truffaut chapter. In all truth, honesty, I woke up late today and I watched this like an hour before we started recording. So it's a little fresh for me, but I didn't do any digging like I usually, or I have done in the past, where I'm like trying to read up on the history of this stuff. This movie kind of sucked. But, and this is an important caveat, this movie was extreme. The story I thought was kind of garbage, but the visuals, a lot of the visuals were amazing. And there was some strange, like as clunky as the story could be, and as sort of cliched as some of the turns in the narrative were, I thought there were interesting moments that introduced, at least to my eyes, a certain ambiguity as to the intent of the scene or like the message of the movie, that I thought made it feel a little more sophisticated than the just pure outline of the story would have you think.
Well, that's where I was feeling that Hitchcock is, what is his level of control over this movie? Because it really did feel like an assignment. And it reminds me of, in the movies we've already done, where he criticized having Ivor Novello as the lodger because he had to change the ending of that movie. In The Mountain Eagle, he criticized having Nita Naldi as the school teacher because she was a sexy vamp actress and the studio wanted her to play this mild-mannered school teacher. So, you know, we talk about Hitchcock as this auteur who has complete control of his movies, but there's clearly elements such as at least casting the leads that are out of his control. And, you know, that opens up, well, what other things are out of his control and what exactly does he have control of? I think for sure, like you're saying, which I'm going to end up agreeing with you when we get to that later, is there's some shots in this that are just dynamite. And that's clearly Hitchcock.
And yeah, and it's probably worth saying that the whole idea of the auteur and the director is like something that you could historically place far after this movie was made. Mm. Like, I don't think there was any expectation that a director be the benevolent dictator that they that we all expect them to be now. They were just the person who coordinated all the various parts of the production, right? So
on behalf of the studio. There's certainly parts where Hitchcock and any artist who's involved, you know, actors, set designers, makeup, any of those people can leave their mark artistically. But I think you certainly get the sense that these stories that we've seen in the, you know, the silent era, the stories tend to be kind of simplistic, kind of moralizing, you know, kind of designed to appeal to, I don't know, a particular audience of a particular era. Definitely not not highbrow. Fair.
No, but there's some nice touches and some nice, you know, a few of the scenes play out and they're like inventive elements. And
sure,
So, and speaking of inventive elements, I found this in doing my pre-research, which I love. This was from Eve Magazine in 1927, a review. So I'm going to read this part of the review because it's something really cool that Ivor Novello did.
I couldn't find a copy of Eve Magazine to read the article myself, but the excerpt is from English Hitchcock, a book by Charles Barr that came out in 2000 and is readily available. And I, for one, will be picking it up.
All right, so here it is. At one part of the film, while screening Downhill, the screen projection fades out, a curtain rolls up, and without breaking the continuity, a scene from the play, as it was done on the stage, is actually acted by Mr. Novello and his schoolboy friend. At the close, they are summoned to the head study, and as the curtain goes down, the camera shows them walking down the cloisters dejectedly. This is an effective screen device and gives Mr. Novello an opportunity of appearing in the flesh before his admirers. I just think that's so rad that this movie, if you were at the premiere of this movie, it just suddenly stopped, a play started, the actual actors from the movie came out, and then it closed and went back to the movie. I've never heard of that before. You can't really do that practically now.
Yeah, that is.
Rocky Horror Picture Show, early days.
Right?
Except with the actual, you know, Tim Curry up there, as opposed to, you know.
And I don't want to talk, I'm going to talk about the cast, I think, as we go through the movie. Because it's a much larger cast than his earlier movies where we could kind of just mention three or four people. But I will mention Ivor Novello. Whether he's cast correctly or not for this, I just think he is absolutely fantastic. Like you can't, when he's on screen, I enjoyed him a lot. Just his presence.
Yeah, I liked Ivor Novello's performance. I think, you know, whatever his age was at the time of filming this and trying to pass himself as like a, you know, pre-college student aside, I thought he was interesting. He rose to the role.
This movie was long too. It was almost 2 hours compared to some, I think Pleasure Garden was like an hour, right? It was, I know it wasn't the full cut, but it was short.
Yeah. There was a lot of story in here. And as with the other silent films silent Hitchcock we've watched, there's an assumption of total focus from the audience. You know, it's not like the way like an atmospheric movie in any way. You know, you have to pay attention. A lot of mechanical stuff happens, like with the plot, and you blink.
You have to read lips. Things.
You have to kind of at least be aware of rituals that might be involved in English life in the 20s. I think there's just like a cultural background that we don't have anymore. That it definitely came up a few points in the movie for me where I'm like, okay, yeah, this is a a public school in England, where they're having a big ritual, or they're early in the film. There's like a scene in the, I don't know what you would call it, like a dining room, I guess, dining room. The point of reference for a contemporary American audience would be like Hogwarts, you know. They're all in this big hall and they're having soup or something.
That's exactly what I thought, Sam. Yeah. This is what I'm watching this. I'm like, okay, finally something I can kind of like anchor myself in. It's Hogwarts.
Hitchcock for the knowing that he did title cards previous to the movies, and these title cards right off the bat rub me the wrong way, because that ski slope behind each letter, again, I came into this movie thinking it was a skiing movie, so then they had these ski slope, I think it's a ski slope, has a flag at the top of it.
I saw it as a meandering path. This is a bit of a Rorschach test for us, I guess.
Yeah, what did you see when you saw it? I didn't like it, though, and it was annoying that it was every title card.
They were illustrative title letters, so like the first letter of the right. sentence would be...
If it was, to be honest, I didn't even notice it, so I'm almost... And perhaps mine had different title cards, which is occasionally a thing, or I am just not very observant, or I was drunk. But I don't recall the title cards. I recall the lack of title cards. That was one thing that was striking about this movie too. That kind of reminded me a bit when we were watching The Lodger, is how few title cards there are. There might be a long conversation, lots of lips moving, lots of emoting. You're following what's going on more or less, and it almost seems, I don't want to say incongruous, but there's so much dialogue that happens without actually hearing any of it in this movie. And, you know, not that, again, you can kind of follow it, but I kind of, in the back of my mind, I feel like, am I just, you know, is it poor lip reading skills? Were people in that era much better lip readers than I am? Or are they just as befuddled as I am in what's happening here, and just kind of going with it? I feel like I'm missing something important when I'm not hearing them speak, and it's just a lot of dialogue and their mouths are obviously moving.
But I think a lot of the time, and this is what I was trying to say before with, you know, just being familiar with the conventions of public school life in the 20s, where you're in this dining hall and you just recognize what's going on because you're familiar as an audience member with, like, you know, even if you've never been to an elite school, you know that this is when they do prayer and they're all speaking Latin right now. And they have a card that gives you the signal that it's the end of prayer. But you would know just from looking that was what was going on. And I think in a lot of these things, there's a visual element that clues you into what gives you the context for the lip reading that you can or you do or don't have to do.
I suspect that people at the time probably leaned over to whoever they were sitting with and discussed.
So starting back from the beginning, and talking about what we could and couldn't decipher. So from the beginning, you've got this shot of a rugby game, and there's this kind of weird, almost close up, like medium kind of close up shot from below of Roddy while you're assuming running down the field, but it really doesn't translate. Like, it looks like he's jogging in place and the camera's stationary. You know, you're supposed to be, it's supposed to be like a close up as, and you're watching, you're tracking with him as he's running down the field to like win the game for the Old Boys. And what it looks like is a guy pretending to move.
Yeah, he was running.
It's one of the most technically glaring, like bad looking shots in the whole movie. And there's a few, but that was like right from the start was one of them. And I was just like, oh my, that didn't work. You know, I don't know what he was watching or what he was basing this on, if this was like Eisenstein or whoever, but like there was definitely an attempt to do something interesting. Look,
but it is an upward shot towards this beautiful blue sky that is his life at that moment, right? Just this endless horizon upward.
Yeah, and he makes a running catch and has the ball in his hand as he lands. And I
had a note on the opening shot too, because I learned that Hitchcock definitely has a flair for coming out with something strong at the very beginning. The Pleasure Garden, it's the vaudeville show, The Lodger, it's the murder, and then this long process of how news is transferred at the time. And with this, we get the actual opening shot is of a referee with a whistle letting us know, here goes the movie.
Yeah.
You know, we get to see Roddy Berwick at his highest peak before any of the downhill comes down. He's the hero. While I do agree with you guys, like, there's a lot of problematic bits, this isn't as strong as some of those other intros. There is this, just being there, the authenticity of having this. He has this giant cast of school kids watching the game. The headmaster is there, his best friend, his father.
The clergy.
Yeah.
This is the first mob that they're in the Hitchcock oeuvre where there isn't an air of menace. It's just... it's celebratory. It's good.
And you get that that title card, the "I wish you had more sons like Roddy to send us, Sir Thomas," from an actor who reminded me a lot of Vincent Price, the headmaster. Yeah,
Peter Cushing.
Yeah, I put that later on in my notes. Yeah, there's a Grand Moff Tarkin vibe going
exactly. Exactly. Yeah, yeah. I was going to mention that in my notes, but then I thought, I'm not going to bring that up.
Yeah, I love the exteriors in this movie. And again, it's not necessarily to do with the film. It has more to do with what we've talked about in the past about, like, these films as artifacts. And there are people on YouTube who post just bland old footage of walking in London in 1910, and they slow down the footage to match what modern would look like. And there are people, including me, who just will watch those for like 10 minutes of just, there's guys walking down the street. And I think part of that, what makes me interested in that, is it's just this world where you look at everyone, this massive crowds of people, and you know they're all dead, they're all gone. That world does not exist anymore. And it's filmed on a medium we're familiar with.
I think the same thing every time. Like, all of these people are dead. And that is amazing to me. It's fascinating to watch, and occasionally, you know, sort of peeking through this, you know, when you're watching an old movie like this and you're, you know, and the prints aren't necessarily always great, you're sort of looking through a smudged mirror of the past. But every once in a while, you sort of get this view or a nice image with good lighting that feels almost natural, and that face or that image from the past seems almost like a little closer. And I always find those moments to be so striking. And that's something that I, you know, you would only get as a modern viewer, obviously. And I guess that to me is probably the number one joy of watching this movie and all the other movies, is just this kind of historical sense. It's not the movies themselves, although there are moments.
I mean, the school exteriors, the city later on, the docks at the end. It's just, there's a lot of exteriors in this film compared to some of the earlier ones. The plot of the movie, really quickly, just a little bit more succinctly for the viewers going along. So we've got our protagonist Downhill Fall is precipitated and enhanced through his relationship with three women in this film. I kind of broke the movie up into those three sections. I know that there's title screens and we'll get to those, I'm sure. But the first one is a server girl named Mabel that accuses him of knocking her up in an attempt to extort him for money. The second involves a successful actress named Julia that he falls in love with, but who only is interested in him after he comes into money through an inheritance. The third is very interesting because he becomes involved with a woman who's basically a pimp named Madame Miche that he is somehow indebted to and working it off as a gigolo. Back to the beginning of the movie, Mabel, the first girl, is played by an actress named
Annette Benson, a British film actress born in Hertfordshire, England. She appeared in over 25 films during the silent era, her career ending, like so many others that we've seen so far, at the start of the sound era in 1930, her last credited film being in 1931. Now, this is the only Hitchcock movie she appears in, but it's not the only time they share credits. She acted in Three Live Ghosts and The Man from Home, both filmed in 1922 by director George Fitzmaurice. Hitchcock is credited with designing the intertitle cards for both of these movies. This was a young Hitchcock on his way up. Both movies were actually recently rediscovered. Three Live Ghosts was found in a Russian archive, and I don't believe it's available to be seen yet. If it is, please link it to us in the comments. The Man from Home was found sitting on a shelf at the I Institute in Amsterdam. That is available on YouTube. And on the casual skimming, it might be something we will do on a shorter episode at some point in the future, because there are some great scenes in there. One of Vinette Benson wrestling with a co-star in the dirt in the daylight scene. Very dramatic. And a scene towards the end where she throws herself in front of a horse-drawn carriage, presumably doing her own stunts. I'm not sure if they'd invented stunt people at the time. There's also a great scene at the end of this where a fella is smoking while Mount Vesuvius is smoking in the background. That's just great. But that's, again, for another episode.
So just at the beginning, and I'll leave it here for a second, the only woman in this movie that is sympathetic, really, is his buddy Tim's sister. Sybil is her name in the credits, who the movie kind of sets up like a little bit of a flirtation. She catches him changing in the dressing room, and you kind of suspect like that that's going to progress into something in the typical movie. And my note for this was just, it's interesting how Hitchcock is willing to spend plot time on these red herring that completely drop out or shift your expectations. Like that character after the accusation of Mabel comes up is gone from the movie and never to return.
That's interesting, because I saw it differently. I saw Sybil as like a, you know, pretty clearly in that setup as a foil for Mabel. She was sort of she had the innocence and very demure demeanor that was contrasted with Mabel, who was 180 degrees the opposite. So even though she was maybe teased as being in a love interest, I think her purpose for the story was to just show how Mabel was at the other extreme.
A little bit of classism there, it almost seems like, but
100%.
All the women are women come off quite badly in this movie, and I'd like to
extend that to people. I don't think there was anyone sympathetic that was central to this story. I think starting with Roddy, the ostensible hero of the story is more of like a dupe. And there are a couple scenes that I thought were really interesting where you see that the generous nature of this guy was kind of self-serving and only really came out of a desire for to be liked. Like there was something really,
he was like a victim of his own virtuousness in a sense. That's what they try to play him up to be.
I guess what I'm trying to say is I don't think the movie liked him. I don't think Hitchcock was showing us his point of view and saying this guy is blameless. Like look what the world did to him. And
do you think Ivor Mordell, who wrote the screenplay, do you think I don't think he intended that. I kind of almost feel like there's a certain naivete in the screen. And Kenny, I think you mentioned earlier that Hitchcock said it was a poor play.
Yeah.
And so clearly he didn't think much of the play. He probably based on that, he kind of phoned it in, but also probably, you know, cast a jaundiced eye on his protagonist as well.
He was so put upon and to such an extreme, and it was so one-sided what happened to him that it was like comical. And yeah. I think that came across in a few scenes. And I guess we could talk about those in a minute, because this action starts. So Mabel, the very forward girl working as a waitress at this school that they're attending, leaves a note, wants to meet up with Roddy,
the captain of the rugby team and all around captain of the school. So he's like academic.
Well, the note was for his friend, right? She slipped.
All right. My first factual error in this.
I think once she goes for Tim and realizes he's friends with Roddy and they both show up is when she switches gears to Roddy. Well, hold on. Before we get to that, Sam, I just want to not gloss over one thing. Before the Mabel plot really gets going, we're introduced to one other character who is my second favorite part of this movie, and that is Sir Thomas Berwick, Roddy's father,
played by the Scottish-born actor Norman McKinnell. McKinnell was a Shakespearean stage actor whose first film credits appear in the first ever film adaptation of Shakespeare in 1899, a film called King John. His film career ended in 1933, not due to the change from silent to talkies, but due to his sudden death of a heart attack a mere 6 years after the release of Downhill.
I loved him. The looks of disdain that he gives in this movie are just withering, and they're almost played for a horror effect later in the movie.
Yeah. He has a very interesting face that catches the kind of the high contrast lighting of the black and white print that I was watching. But yeah, I agree. It is almost, he has these piercing blue eyes that are just withering, and he has this, you know, patrician air about him that you can see how domineering he is as a character. So yeah, I would agree. He's probably one of the characters that I liked.
I just didn't want him to be skipped over right there, because he does have a great scene at the dinner table when he sees Roddy come in with Mabel, and Mabel's like putting her foot on his foot, and then he gives Roddy the look, the first withering look.
Yeah, and I guess in the first 5 minutes when Tim and Sybil are walking around, they see him after the game. That the scene you're talking about, Kenny, and then we get the hint that Tim is there on scholarship, which
the father says, "I might even be able to, I might be able to afford to send you to Oxford." So that was a kind of a small scene, but it was pretty pivotal in how things play out later, right? Because we know that Roddy he's set, you know, he's a child of wealth and privilege, whereas it seems like his friend Tim is a little more vulnerable in his status.
And here's something that I think is like a element of public school culture or English culture from the time, is the idea of the school bond, and like the, you know, young men especially who go to school together and form friendships at school. The romanticized version of that, of deep bonds and sacrifices that you would make for your schoolmates and all that stuff I've read about and appears in English novels and literature and stuff from the time. And I feel like this might be a example of that in this story. This is sort of like an old worn out concept or device. So they go to Ye Old Bun Shop to meet up with Mabel, and
the Old Bun Shop.
Yeah, which is definitely a pun, right? Like, you guys are like, you know, for what happened later in the movie. Yeah. So they go to the Ye Old Bun Shop at the set time. And by the way, there's this cool, I don't know if it was before or after.
Mabel's shop, right? So just to be clear.
Yeah, there's this cool match cut shot too, where like you see the pocket watch of the time they're supposed to meet, and then it fades to the clock. I don't know why I made a note of that. I like when I notice like these movies, and the first couple ones, you know, the shots were a little more static. And this is the first of the Hitchcock movies where I like, there were a few shots that really made a huge impression on me. The Lodger had that cool invisible floor shot, but there were a bunch of shots in this movie that just seemed like they didn't require as much production, but they were just as cool and impactful. So anyway, they go, Mabel is now interested in both Tim and Roddy. They dance. She kisses him. Is that right? I don't know. My notes are kind of scattered here.
He's all over Roddy, and Roddy's a better dancer. Remember, they made a show of Tim stepping on Mabel's feet.
They
and
did.
Roddy was just obviously much more desirable, but Roddy spurns her advances, and that's very, very crucial to that. She keeps trying to, you know, come back to him. And he keeps redirecting her back to his buddy, Tim.
That's right.
It's a good wingman.
Yeah, he's a good wingman. He's the wingman you'd want.
And here's the scene where I think you get the first hint, and it's not a hint. It's shouted at you that Roddy might be kind of a dupe and just not really understand life in a fundamental way. He's just he comes from this world where he's just so divorced from reality.
Very sheltered and naive.
Yeah. So while Mabel and Tim are in the back, he's minding the front. And a poor kid comes, like a street urchin straight out of Charles Dickens, comes in, and he gives him a bun. Is it free? Does he take money? No, he...
There's a half pence, and he gave him like this big box, like that was obviously... That was a very puzzling scene for me to watch again, I think, because if you're an audience at that time, you know exactly what's happening there. But for me, I was like, gosh, that seems like an awful lot to give him for like a half pence. And it was.
Okay. Yeah. The currency is being exchanged is kind of obscure to me too. Like I had to look it up, in a pound note was like $100 bill.
That was a lot of money.
Yeah. In 1927. Yeah. So anyway, he gives the kid more than he paid for. And he's really grateful. And he comes back and everyone's feeling good. And Roddy definitely is. He's got a little self-satisfaction of just like it's a very whimsical scene. He comes across as this like benevolent spirit, you know?
Novello is basically playing like the wealthy son with no real understanding of what wealth is. It's basically an F. Scott Fitzgerald, J.D. Salinger, or a Wes Anderson type character.
Yeah.
Where his connection to wealth is not super clear. He doesn't understand it. And it's not a worry necessarily.
Also the nature of poverty. So this, you know, benevolent gesture isn't over for like a second before the kid comes back with a bunch of his friends. And then you realize that the whimsy and the, you know, the, like you were saying, Kenny, the kind of like, I thought of Wes Anderson too, just like the look on his face. And you realize that he just doesn't understand. He doesn't understand poverty. He doesn't understand. He thinks it's like, you know, give the kid some food and the problem goes away. And I think the movie is really just showing you how sheltered and unaware he is in that moment. And
the kids really make that scene for me too. And it was another note I had about the way he casts extras in these movies. They feel like they're just plucked right off the street. It's definitely not a central casting Spielberg pick the children out of lineups. It feels like dirty kids. They're wearing the clothes that they found them in. And they're all shoved out of the room by Mabel. They're very authentic in the moment, I guess.
And he makes Mabel shove them out, which is cool. You know?
Yeah.
And I think that tells you that what we're supposed to think about Roddy at that moment, of just someone who's completely like, once he gets in over his head, is just like happy to disclaim any responsibility and put it on someone else.
I have an analysis at this point that is probably my biggest, this is the biggest one I'm going to have for this whole episode that I spent hours and hours working on for you guys. So if you give me just one quick second to go down a rabbit hole, also with our viewers at home. There's a shot in this movie that I love, and we just kind of glossed over it. When Mabel invites them to the confection shop and they come in, she brings them to a back room. And the first thing we see is she puts a record on. I want to talk about this shot because I've looked very, very deeply into it. Hitchcock shows a close-up of the record that he's putting on, and the label shows a record that exist for a record label that existed at the time, Winner Records in the United Kingdom, manufactured by Edison Bell. The word winner alone gives us a hint in Mabel's personality. But moving on, the title of the song is I Want Some Money by a band listed as Bohemian Band. So everything on the record label is great because it lets us know what we need to know about Mabel. Turns out she does want some money. She is Bohemian, which is an artistic type.
Someone wild, free, unattached.
She's a wanton woman, I think was the term.
So, of course, I did the digging into Bohemian Band from the 1920s to see if this existed. And I found
very little, almost nothing. According to Discogs.com, Bohemian Band was a studio orchestra which recorded for Edison Bell Winner between 1912 and 1925. The only other information I could turn up on Bohemian Band comes from YouTube commenter Norman Field 12 years ago, where he said the versatile pseudonym was quite widely used by many labels from 1912 into the 1930s. Take that with a grain of salt, but I did thumbs up his comment.
And as we move back in time, we lose information. It's funny, like the Mountain Eagle, we completely lose a movie.
So does this record still exist? Is there still an audio copy of I Want Some Money by Bohemian Band available anywhere?
I don't know. I couldn't find it online, but what I did find online was a song called I Want Some Money that had been recorded at Winter Records by a band called
The Versatile Three, recorded back in 1922. The Versatile Three, also known as the Versatile Four,
was one of the first small groups of African-American musicians to perform in Britain and Europe.
According to a review of the sheet music I found over at Abe Books, I mean, this is how deep we have to look for information.
The group played the kind of ragtime on string instruments that didn't keep up with the jazz that was developing in America, and they performed overseas in Europe due to, you guessed it, racial issues in America. And this is mostly from an article I read on theridgebooks.com. So silent movies don't have sound, right? Obviously. We have to imagine the sound. But Hitchcock does something here that is really great. And as a modern audience, we will miss every time, as we just kind of missed it now. By showing this record to his British audience of a song that they would have been familiar with, he instantly puts music into all of the people sitting in the audience's heads, thereby giving a silent movie sound, which is brilliant. And it's the same as if we put a Michael Jackson record up in a silent, if we had silent film right now.
Just think about how it changes this scene.
We would all know it, and we would all start thinking that song. A modern audience has no idea what I Want Some Money sounds like. So the audience at the time would hear the Versatile Three singing, I want some money, give me some, give me some, give me some, give me some. He gives a silent movie sound with an image. Love it. So the problem is that song is not available anywhere. I could not find a version to listen to. What I did find was sheet music, which is up on the screen right now.
Our challenge for the musically inclined is to record yourself playing this song, I Want Some Money, Gimme Some, Gimme Some. Words by Herbert, Rule and Hold, music by Silberman. At least the chorus. Either link us to it on the comments, YouTube, TikTok, whatever works for you, or send us a link at moroniclogic@gmail.com. If you're shy, just play the movie, the scene from the movie, and put the song over that. And also, bonus challenge, if you are a 78 RPM record collector, please check your collections for this album by Bohemian Band. If you own it, you own an obscure piece of Hitchcock history and you probably didn't even know it. And we would love to hear the actual record from the movie play in a YouTube video. Or send us a link. We will help you out with that. It would be so cool. So you have your marching orders.
I will add a reminder that I could be completely wrong. This analysis could be off. We're not scholars. Mabel's a winner. But this, I just had to go down this rabbit hole with you guys. So,
Kenny, that was awesome. Yeah, and you know what? You're right. We completely missed that because I think when you watch this, you take for granted soundtracks and films. And doing that with image is definitely an inventive thing. But you know, like what you just said was really true. It's that if you don't have a soundtrack, but you show a song that everyone knows, that's a fresh way to think. I think this movie is full of things like that. It's also full of, and here's the weird thing about this movie is that it has things like that, that are clearly just them having fun. And then it has we can get into that later, but I felt like a lot of the scenery just looked fake. And the worst one was the headmaster's office, where it really looked like a set. There were things that looked painted, like bookcases and stuff.
And I thought it was a backdrop when they show Roddy and Tim walking into the room. They show the door open and they show the...
Yeah, it looked incredibly bad. And so it's an inconsistent movie visually.
Let's talk about that scene for a minute, though, because it does have... I mean, that is a pivotal scene of the movie, right? So moving forward.
You're missing the coronation ceremony.
Roddy appointed captain of the school.
Oh yeah, that's very important, right? So yes, yeah, he was appointed captain of the old boys, which is the rugby team.
Yeah,
for next year.
He gets a cap that says honor on it, just to drive home.
Right,
that he's an honorable guy.
Yeah, he's just going straight to the top. He's on a freight train to the moon, Roddy.
Yeah, there's a shot, and I think this would be called on the nose today. There's this one shot of like the captain's cap with the honor button, and it's on top of the ye old sweet shop box.
And like, that's oh, right. Yeah. Yeah, his honor is lost. I mean, it was really the wanton woman. They were lured into her bohemian lair with these beaded curtains, you know, and so. It all goes downhill from there, as we discover later when they're called into the headmaster's office.
The beaded curtain was like a class thing, right? Like that, you were supposed to know that Mabel was like a lower class girl. Like
I think it was an artistic thing. I think it was a bohemian thing.
I think it was bohemian, and it's also it's offbeat. I think it's certainly not a middle class, you know, something that would be in a.
Yeah, but I felt like in just in terms of visual symbolism, like. You have him going through this beaded curtain, you know, there were a lot of doorways and thresholds and all that kind of stuff.
Awesome.
And
I
feel like entering into that world, you know, there's like a little bit of the class tourist.
It was definitely intended to communicate and message what I think we all picked up in our own way. And that's that they're sort of stepping through this threshold into a world that is not, that is dangerous, you know, somehow. But yes, yeah, so they go back into the so they go to see the headmaster calls for both of them, but they go to the headmaster's, they walk in and they see Mabel sitting on a chair next to the door, and the headmaster has this very stern look on his face, and he was basically asking her which one did it.
I love that shot because as she's walking towards them, they do it a few times in that scene where the camera is moving with. You know, Roddy and Tim when they're walking towards, and then kind of to set up the suspense of it. But when she's walking towards them, you get that she's looking at both of them, and it ends. The last shot is over both of their shoulders, and she's looking right at the camera, at the viewer. And it's very terrifying because you can see her just glaring, and she almost seems like she's going to walk between their shoulders. She's like, she gets so close to them, and it's almost like she's going to do the grudge and come right through the screen at us. And that was a great, terrifying shot. For me, that's a Hitchcock shot that wouldn't have been there with someone else doing it. That really worked for me.
It was a great shot. And then as she tells the story of, you know, how she got pregnant.
She pins it on Roddy, basically.
Yeah, we you know, the suspense is mounting. And, you know, there's just this montage. There's nice. Well, the first... that I noticed of the double exposure effects in this movie, which there were a lot of, where you over her face, you see the reenactment of everything that happened in the movie until that point, which was really effective. And, you know, contrasted, like I speaking of acting, like I thought her acting in this scene was pretty good.
Basically an affront and a terror to middle-class values. You know, that's kind of like the impression that I got, right? Is that, she was this wanton woman that would lead these, you know, these promising young men astray, and because she had no control over her own appetites, and once she had one of them, you know, her hooks in one of them, then that was it, you know, and that was and
Lance, well said that, you know, the fear of being unable to control your appetites or your impulses or whatever that's like all over this scene, but then as she leaves. Is it still in that scene? I kind of forget where she says like his father's rolling in money. He'll have to.
Yeah. It's during that.
It is. Yeah. So she's still in the headmaster's office and she says that out loud, which is like, I don't know, kind of a
giveaway.
I do think that now these days you would have a paternity test, right? But apparently, you know, I mean, that was not available then. So if she claimed that one of them did it, then, you know, it was that guy. And Roddy allowed it, right? Because he's a, through his noble and virtuous self, he recognizes that Tim, if Tim is takes the fall for it, his life will be ruined because he won't get a scholarship, he won't go to Oxford, and he doesn't have a father who has a sir in front of his name. His circumstances are more tenuous than Roddy's. So Roddy takes the fall for him like a good guy, like a good, you know, mate, and they go back, and basically Tim is like, you know, sort of apologizing and sort of whimpering and kind of sniveling and kind of pathetic. And then they have their parting, and, you know, it's like, you know, don't worry, your secret's safe with me. No one will ever find out. And yeah, Roddy goes home.
It's noblesse oblige all the way. It's
right.
Yeah. Like, it's what the exactly. upper class is, how they'd like to see themselves. And the idea that it's so ruinous to him as he lives in exile is sort of like the only subversive element.
All right, so let me progress us a little bit into the movie. The scene, Roddy comes home after being expelled, and he has to admit to his father that he's been expelled.
Before you get into that, where does he live? Because it, like, I thought that was Piccadilly Square, right?
It was crazy because you see these like lights and it's like Times Square, you know.
But they did. It does have the address, like, or like Thomas, or like you do see an address show up at some point, and
yeah.
So if any viewers know where that address is and they want to send us a photo of it, that would be awesome.
Oh, yeah, that'd be cool, actually. Yeah, modern. What does it look like right now?
There's also Google Maps for that we could do.
Yeah, we could do that work, but we have a lot of other work to do. That's why we have people helping us here.
Location, location, location. Having chosen the banks of the Thames for his third movie, The Lodger, Alfred Hitchcock chose Piccadilly Square, the center and heart of London, in the 1920s for his fourth film, Downhill, which also seems to be the location of Roddy Berwick's very wealthy and affluent parents, the Berwicks. So exactly what is Piccadilly Circus, you might be asking, if you are a part of our American audience? Well, I'll tell you. Sorry, something in my throat. Well, I'll tell you. According to the Legends of London at WordPress.com, picadilles were pieces of material used to support stiff collars or ruffs, which were popular during the Elizabethan times and in vogue in the royal courts. A fellow named Robert Baker, who was a well-known tailor, built a shop that made picadilles. It was instantly nicknamed Piccadilly Hall. The hall was later demolished. The area became a busy thoroughfare with crossroads. In the early 1900s, electrically illuminated advertising boards appeared. And in 1910, the famous Bovril and Schweppes signs were erected, followed by a Guinness clock, which you can see in the movie Downhill right here, and in future Hitchcock movies such as Blackmail and The 39 Steps, and possibly others. We'll get there. During World War II, Piccadilly Circus was the code name used by the Allied forces during the D-Day invasion and as an assembly point for the fleet in the English Channel. The famous Bovril sign lasted until at least 1956, when it was replaced by Max Factor. Recently, brands such as Amazon Prime Video and IWC Schaffhausen have wowed audiences both in person and online with stunning deep screen activations, which appear to jump off the screen. This from OceanOutdoor.com, the Piccadilly Lights.
So he's explaining to his father what happened. There's a lot of suspense about his dad coming home and him telling him. And his father's great throughout the scene because every emotion on his face, he's very, for the silent era, you can read exactly what's going on. You can see when he realizes he shouldn't be home. You can see everything is told on his face. So he's walking away, and apparently Roddy is explaining that it wasn't him. Basically, what I wrote down is, we don't need, as the audience, to have a title card for when he says liar, because he's walking away and then he turns back and says it just with absolute force, yelling at the camera. But the Hitchcock uses the title card liar like a jump scare. Midway through him saying the word liar, boom, the title card comes up in all caps, liar. And it kind of gives you a bit of a jolt that if he had just said liar, we would have known what he said because we'd have seen his mouth right there. But that title card's actually added there, which is kind of contrary to how Hitchcock normally operates, where he wants to use less cards. It's used as a jump scare, and it's really successful. It sets up nightmares that he's going to have later towards the end of the film dealing with his father.
I didn't sort of analyze that to the extent that you did, but now that you think about it, it was like, in lieu of not having, you know, a dialogue where you can have someone say liar, you know, really loud, you know, in a stentorian voice, you know, he just flashed that on the screen. And it is a very, very effective.
It's the original somebody online writing in all caps where you know they're yelling.
Yeah.
But this is 45 minutes into the movie. I wrote it down. And finally, Roddy is going downhill officially.
He exiles himself because he's called a liar. And again, this, to use the term Sam did, the noblesse oblige, like no respectable man would allow himself to be besmirched with that name. And he's like, I won't stay in this house. So he leaves. The father locks the door, and there's he latches the door with the chain afterwards, just as sort of the final, you know, exclamation point on the end of that. And then he goes to this London Underground, and then there's that super obvious metaphor where it's like the camera is, you know, pointing. It's like underground. You can go anywhere in the underground, and so he's just descending on the escalator down into the tubes. You know, just going down the tubes, literally going down the tubes.
And he's taking a midnight train going anywhere.
It's a little on the nose.
Yeah.
But then the next scene, and so this is where we get into part two, which is I thought, what was it? So what is this? The World of Illusion, I think, is what part two is called, right? It says on the title card, World of Illusion. So it is a very cool shot, and it's one of the more inventive ones, or just, I guess, visual pun, where he's wearing a tuxedo, and you, for a moment, because you're only looking at him from the other half, you're like, oh, well, so what's going on here? I thought he was, descendant, but he's wearing a tuxedo. And then it pulls back and he's got an apron on. And he's obviously a waiter. And you're like, oh.
That was one of my favorite shots, too. Yeah. I love the center framing. And there was a little bit of a psychological aspect to the shot. It made you feel or maybe this is all projection, but you felt the interiority, whatever, the character. You felt that there was some turmoil happening, but it was a really nice misdirect, rug pull.
And then it was a double misdirect. That was what is especially cool about it, because not only was it a misdirect that he's a waiter, but then the camera pulls back a little bit more, and he's actually on stage, and he's just like a bit player in a play. Yeah. So I thought that was, in my mind, that was one of the more sort of visually inventive and clever parts of the movie, which otherwise, from there forward, again, it just comes back to the same. It's really the same story, in a sense, as the first one. He's obviously attracted to the lead of the play, what is her name?
Isabel Jeans was an English stage actress since the age of 15. This, according to Wikipedia. Notably, she appeared in Ivor Novello's hit play The Rat in 1924, which might have been her pathway to meeting Hitchcock for her role here in Downhill. Clearly a fan of hers, Hitchcock also cast her as the star of his very next movie, Easy Virtue, which, spoiler alert, we will be talking about next time. Isabel is one of the lucky few actresses, it seems, that was able to maintain her career into the sound era, and will appear one more time in the Hitchcock movie it'll be our episode 30, for Suspicion. Anyway, we will probably have much more to say about her next time.
And in this movie, she's the star actress of a vaudeville / theater production, along with her stage partner and backstage boyfriend, a fella named Archie.
Archie, and what is her name? Her character?
Her name is Julia in the movie.
Julia, that's right. So he takes a shine to Julia, and Julia is obviously, you know, likes the attractions of this handsome young man, but, you know, he doesn't have any prospects. But then all of a sudden, Roddy gets this amazing letter in the mail that says that he's inherited £30,000, which, as we've discussed earlier, is it's a fortune.
Oh, there's a cat.
Well, it's I looked it up, and I think it was something like $400,000 and $500,000.
Yeah,
today's money. So it's definitely a a lot of money to live comfortably for a while, but it's not a bottomless well.
So as we discover, as we learn, but that is enough to sort of woo her, because he actually literally goes, and this is ridiculous. It's like, he literally, and this is, yes, why I would agree with you, Kenny, this whole part of the movie is just absolutely idiotic. But he goes to her and he shows her the letter. He's like, "Hey, look, I'm rich. Will you go out with me?" And she's like, "Oh, wow." You know, and then I think Archie, sort of, he has all these, I guess, sales slips of gowns that she's bought and, you know, boots and whatever. And he's like, "You're going to need these. Consider it your
entrance fee." I think
your entrance fee, right? Yeah, something like that. And
that was such a bitter character.
Oh yeah, he was. He was just he was. Yeah.
I felt like a movie starring Archie and Julia just ripping off young idiot rich guys would probably be more interesting than what we kind of got here from Roddy's perspective. I do want to mention there's a scene where he's, before he gets the inheritance, I dog marked this one for a reason, where he doesn't have an overcoat because he's poor. So they kind of give him a ride to the bus stop after he hits on her unsuccessfully.
Yeah.
And there's a scene, and I would have really loved this scene, but it's pouring rain, and it's one of those double-decker buses. And the first floor, you're safe from getting wet. The second floor, it's pouring. So everyone's fighting to get on the first floor. So he, you know, sad sack Roddy, heads to the second floor, where there's a couple making out under an umbrella, and he interrupts them. I wanted to say originally I liked that scene, but I watched it again the second time, and I realized the main problem I have is that it's clearly not Ivor Novello getting soaked in the rain, but a very badly chosen stunt double with a guy with a 5 o'clock shadow. And when you look at it closely, I'll put the image up right here. It reminds me of the stunt doubles from Spaceballs.
Spectacular stunt, my friends, but all for naught. Turn around, please. Ah, what a pity. What a pity. So, Princess, you thought you could outwit the imperious force of... You idiots! These are not them. You've captured their stunt doubles!
It's ridiculous. It's not Ivor Novello.
So that's so funny, because I didn't necessarily pick up that it wasn't him, but I didn't. I was like... Yes, I was confused, because I was like, was that Ivor Novello? Was that supposed to be him? I guess I just didn't recognize him.
He's distinctive looking that you can't just stick a guy with a trench coat.
He's just some other guy. So yeah, that whole scene I was confused by, because I wasn't sure. Because he got on the bus and I was like, wow, Ivor Novello can't be bothered to get wet.
Right? Like the actor himself is like, well, I might catch a cold up
there. Yeah, I don't do my own stunts. Ivor Novello does not get wet.
He's as frail in real life as he was in all the pictures that he, which we'll get to the fight. We are going to get to the fight.
Oh yeah, the fight. Yeah, we should discuss that right now.
Well, I want to say before we go any further, and this is such a small note, I don't even know if it's worth mentioning, but one of to just get keep on the theme of interesting camera work. I loved the shot when he is returning, when he's. When he's flirting with Julia, he's obviously attempting to court her. He's just sort of drawn to her, and he's returning her cigarette case. He says, "You know, that's like the excuse for him going into her dressing room," and she sees him. It's her point of view. She's languid, kind of lying in a chair, and you see him upside down, and then you get that it's her point of view. It's just one of those little things in the movie that I loved, and it was just.
She's got that cigarette in her mouth too, which is very indolent. And
there was a lot to tell us in that scene.
Lot to tell us, let me just mention too the newspaper article that announces that the line in the newspaper article they show on the screen says famous actress weds Miss Julia Fotheringale, the well-known actress who was married in London yesterday to Mr. Roddy Berwick. I have a lot of questions, like why his parents didn't hear about this, how much time has passed.
I liked the wedding being declared as a newspaper announcement, and you see the couple like well-wishing attendees, but it was just a really, I mean, at this point it's well-trod territory, but I think in 1927, maybe the idea of Eliding that part of the narrative, not having to show a big wedding or film a big ceremony, but to just do it with a newspaper notice. It had like an economy. You didn't really need to see the wedding for the story. But when you see the newspaper notice, you get, okay, this is a couple who has their wedding announced in the, you know, whatever it was, Times of London. So it lets you know it's a class signifier, to use a pretentious term. It lets you know that he's still in the world of having his wedding in the paper. So he's gone downhill, but he's still pretty high up.
His fortune has sort of taken a, you know, going a bit uphill, but this is just a denouement until he
really sucks. Another little thing that I thought was like a funny visual gag, and this movie's full of visual gags, some of them funny, some of them not. This isn't really funny, but it was just amusing, was when he got the inheritance and it was £30,000. It was big. And then after a couple of weeks of marriage, the £30,000 or months or whatever was tiny. And I don't know. It was just,
they set up the fact that she's obviously a gold digger. Right.
And we know that he's an idiot.
So we come to a scene of they've obviously been married for, we don't know how long.
But they've been married long enough that he's now overdrawn from his bank. She's hanging out with Archie in their house.
In the bedroom.
Archie's like hanging out with her. And he's like, have you been transferring this to the other bank? Or, you know, giving her some advice about, like, obviously they've been fleecing him, like, together.
Yeah.
And so, and then he comes home and she pushes Archie into the wardrobe.
Was that a wardrobe or a... I saw three doors.
Yeah, it was a closet. It had the look of a wardrobe, but it was like a three-door closet. Is it,
okay, so it's a three-door closet or whatever. Or he starts chastising her about the overdrawn account. And then I don't remember exactly what happened, but he sat down and then Archie's hat, his top hat happens to be there, just sitting there. Oops, forgot about the hat. And so he's like, what's going on here? And he goes up into her boudoir, and he's looking around. He looks under the bed, and then he looks at the closet, the three doors, and he incorrectly surmises the first door, and then you see Archie coming out the other one, trying to sneak out the other door.
But Archie has a characteristic cough that he can't seem to stop.
Yeah, he always coughs and gives it away, right? Yeah, cough. And they start one of the most ridiculous fight scenes that I've ever seen.
It reminded me of a Bugs Bunny fight. And Roddy is supposed to be a star athlete. We're supposed to believe he's the star athlete of the football team.
Well, Archie's a clear guy. Archie's just holding his hands the most of the fight. He's just holding his hands. And it's like he's trying to hit him, but Archie is just holding his hands. And that's what most of the fight consists of, is...
And Julia grabbing the vase like in the Warner Brother cartoon before it falls off the pedestal while they tussle.
Showing you what she really cares about in the...
In a way over the top, hammer it home.
Yeah, completely. And the stunt fighting was they should have had Ivor Novello's stunt double do this.
Right.
That would have been a lot better.
He did not sell anything. Like, I don't know what the state of stunt fighting was, but you watch this and you think that, this isn't one of Hitchcock's strengths early on. Like, he doesn't know how to do action.
No, it was comical, you know, unintentionally comical and amusing to watch in a way that was obviously not intended,
there were slapstick moments.
Yeah, Archie sneezing comes back into play after he gets punched onto the ground.
And before the scene ends, you know, he glances over and there's a stuffed Dalmatian next to him. And I think that was sort of slapstick. It felt like the tone of the scene was not totally serious, is what I'm trying to say.
Right.
There was an element of comedy in it, intentional. But the fight choreography was the unintentional part.
Yeah. The only other thing I had to say on this whole thing is the one thing that was kind of pulled from it was when Julia throws him out. That did suddenly shift to kind of terrifying. But the actress has this really great, you know, she's obviously great for the silent era because she has these big whites of her eyes that in this scene, when she's throwing him out, she's being so angry. And then he snaps back to kind of old school boy Roddy for a second, tries to play it off like it's a joke, but she's just, no, you are gone. And my note on the scene was just that both of the women characters now, Mabel and now her, just snap into these complete disregard for Roddy, even as a human being. There's no, their cares are the money, which is why these characters are so poorly drawn. Moving on to Roddy going down an elevator.
Yeah. And the metaphorical elevator, the next downward.
Next stop down, next ring of hell.
This is interesting. This is an interesting ring of hell. That for, especially for the movies of the time, and even for now, you don't really see men as gigolos in movies, which is sure. basically what he is.
I was kind of like, what the going on here? Because it was definitely a very...
no explanation. You're just thrown into it. He owes this woman money for some reason. I guess we're left to assume that she helped him out when he got thrown out. And it's not entirely clear the situation. Women are being charged $50 to dance with him. Although France. The dance...
So he's in France, which I think is funny.
Right.
Because it's a very English-looking building. I think it's supposed to be like Moulin Rouge, but it's the windmill, which I think was a musical. This is the one little piece of research I did. I was like, I didn't know there's a windmill music hall in England at the time. And there was. But then the story, you get the idea that you're supposed to be in France.
Sam totally noticed something that the rest of us missed. This does indeed seem to be the Moulin Rouge in Act 3 of Downhill. The Moulin Rouge, for those that don't know, is a cabaret in Paris, France. So what exactly is the Moulin Rouge? Going to Kelly Richmond Abdu from MyModernMet.com. The Moulin Rouge made its grand debut on October 6th, 1889. The cabaret was built at the bottom of a hill in Montmartre, an artistic neighborhood in Paris. Here, members of all Parisian social classes mix, setting the scene for the cabaret's wild popularity. In its formative years, the Moulin Rouge made a name for itself as Paris' premier place for entertainment. Every night, guests would pour into the club, tempted by an offering of bubbly and a show. The cabaret quickly became known for the lively routines of its dancers, namely the can-can, a high-energy dance that called for a chorus line of dancers performing famously revealing high kicks. In 1921, the Moulin Rouge reopened under new management after a fire, and presumably this is the one Hitchcock would have become familiar with for Downhill. I could not find any specific references online to prostitution or gigolos working at the actual Moulin Rouge itself, so whether or not this is him being critical of the place, or whether this is something he himself witnessed from visiting it, or whether it was popular knowledge at the time, I don't know. I couldn't really find anything in my short research window here before this episode. But according to some quick online research done at Online Etymology Dictionary or edemonline.com, the word gigolo was apparently a relatively new word when the movie Downhill premiered, having its origins in 1922 from French gigolo, meaning a professional male escort or dancing partner, a young man supported financially by an older woman in exchange for his attentions. Alfred Hitchcock, however, was not the first to latch onto this term. That award would go to Cecil B. DeMille, who produced a movie called Gigolo in 1926, 1 year before Downhill. In 1931, another American movie, Just a Gigolo, premiered, and a year after that, Evenings for Sale, another American romantic comedy, presumably about gigolos, premiered. In the world of music, I'm a Gigolo was a Broadway show tune by Cole Porter that came out in 1929, and Just a Gigolo was a song adapted by Irving Caesar in 1929 from an Austrian tango. And in 1932, only 5 years after the first sound film in 1927, a cartoon starring Betty Boop introduced Irene Bordoni to sing Just a Gigolo.
There will come a time, you will pass away. Then what will return about me? When the end comes, I know they'll say just a gigolo.
It wouldn't be until 1988, however, until someone perfected the song Just a Gigolo, and that was David Lee Roth in the spectacular, unsurpassed edition, Just a Gigolo, I Ain't Got Nobody. No disrespect to Fats Waller, Louis Armstrong, Bing Crosby, Thelonious Monk, Sarah Vaughan, The Village People, Tiny Tim, and many others, but I think we can all agree that David Lee Roth nailed it.
Yeah, he's basically, a gigolo where he's paying these wealthy matrons are, you know, paying for a dance, presumably. They don't insinuate that it's anything more than a dance. It's really, you know, maybe just the company of these young men.
There's the insinuation that the dance is code.
Yes.
That because when we flash back at the end, you
well, so there's a character who's listed in the credits as the poetess. Violet Fairbrother was an English film actress that appeared in 25 films, her first being an adaptation of Richard III done in 1911. It was a short, though. At least 19 minutes of it are available online right now for you to find and watch. It is basically a single camera filming the scene, a lot like watching a play. It is from 1911. Her second movie being Downhill from 1927. She appeared in a number of plays and was a stage actress. She'd been in The Scarlet Pimpernel for a number of years. And right before Downhill, she was in a play called Joanna Godden, which was based on a popular book from the time. There's not much about her that I could find online, but I would suspect that perhaps Ivor Novello or Constance Collier would have known her from the theater world and introduced her to Hitchcock that way. Hitchcock clearly liked her because he cast her in his next three movies. So she's here in Downhill, 1927. She's in the next movie, Easy Virtue, also from 1927. Rather big role. And she will appear again in Murder, a sound film from 1930. Her career went into the 1960s. She appeared in movies, television series, and television movies, including a show called Contract to Kill in 1965. So even though she had a small resume, it did span a number of years.
There was a sort of sympathy that I had for her when I was watching, because she's this lonely woman who's there, who really just is desperately craving the attention of this handsome young man. And I felt a certain, you know, I definitely felt a kind of like, I don't know, empathy, you know.
Well, Hitchcock sets her up for sure as the one woman in the room maybe that is going to be real with Roddy, because even when Roddy sits down with her, he says there's something authentic about you, and he keeps looking at her when he's dancing with the other women. So I think Hitchcock is trying to get our sympathies with her, that maybe this is going to be an ally for Roddy.
It's he winds up kind of spilling his guts and telling his life story to this woman who he's been set up with on a date now or to dance with, and she's, you know, looking earnestly, but almost like, you know, when she's looking at him, you know, as he tells his, you know, sob story. I don't know if the artifice was intentional or not, the way that she's looking at him, like, oh, you poor thing, or if she's just doing that to elicit, you know, to get him to feel like she is a sympathetic voice, but she's just like everybody else.
Yeah.
I don't know. I didn't quite know what to make of that scene. And I think maybe I was also kind of drifting in and out of interest, you know, at that point.
The scene is just completely depressing. The minute, especially when the band starts to pack up and leave, and there's one couple still dancing just erratically on the dance floor, there's a man passed out in his seat, like backwards with his head hanging. And there's just all these women from different ages. They're either drunk or wearing too much makeup with these older men in this smoke-filled room.
Well, the curtains, right. Remember, they opened the curtains because that one guy's...
The big part of it is that the fella starts coughing. And so they go to quickly open all the windows and open the blinds, and the sun comes in. And this is where Roddy is looking across the room. The camera kind of pans for some of it. And he's seeing for the first time, like, wow, I'm in a bad spot right now. And I put, oh, she's looking into the camera. It does a close up on her face. And this is where it gets creepy. And you could read her words there, because I wrote them down anyway. She's saying, so she's looking right at him, which is where supposed to be Ivor Novello. And she's saying,
come on, come home with me.
Okay.
And then this is where he, of course, just finally stands up and decides, you know, I'm bailing on this whole situation. Yeah. And she's out for one thing, and it's not, you know, to be an ally to.
She's feigning sympathy in order to get into his good graces, in order to kind of woo him, you know, get his defenses down. I guess presumably that's what that word was supposed to be happening. Was that? Yeah, that's, I think I was tuning out.
Yeah, this movie is very long, as we've said. So we skip after this part to, there's a title screen that says down, it says the title of the movie. I always love when, you know, when musicians sing the title of their band, when movies mention the title of their movies. It says Downhill till what was left of him was thrown to the rats of a Marseille dockside. You know, it's rough for Roddy now because we cut to him tripping out in a hovel populated by a young black man that is not credited at all. A Tom Waits looking sailor who's white.
Well, they're both sailors, right?
They're both sailors. But the Tom Waits fella is credited at the beginning. And the third person that they're hanging out with is an overweight woman in blackface. I could not find any credits for who played this on IMDb or anywhere. I couldn't find anything on her. And as far as I'm concerned, Hitchcock could have been playing her because I thought it was a man as well at one point. They don't do a lot of close-ups on her at all.
If you are watching this on YouTube, then you are looking at a picture of Alfred Hitchcock in profile along with this woman in blackface in profile, and you will notice they look almost identical.
I want to say that while we can come here and admire the work of Alfred Hitchcock, I am not going to pretend he's a faultless saint or defend him against anything from this movie to future movies. There are going to be issues that rise up with actors. But what comes to my mind in all of these situations with artists who have bad things that we have to deal with is there's a line in the movie Synecdoche, New York by Charlie Kaufman where Catherine Keener says,
everyone is disappointing. The more you know someone, it just.
And I firmly believe that. There is a history of racism on planet Earth, and the history of cinema is contained within that. It's all just baked in. So I'm not shocked that there's a character in blackface in this movie, just disappointed. I will say the acting from Ivor Novello in the scene is fantastic.
Yeah, so is this supposed to be, I wasn't clear. Was this supposed to be like an opium?
Flop house, right?
Yeah, it's a flop house, but like, is there like a hookah on the table? I
didn't see like that. I didn't see drugs. I just kind of felt like he, I don't know if he was ill or it was alcohol.
He's in a delirium.
And
there's a suggestion that it's narcotic because at some point, one of the sailors offers a bottle of wine to him and the, you know, the character who's supposed to be the as Kenny pointed out, the woman in blackface, whoever that was, like swipes the bottle away as though like, no, he doesn't need any more. That was how I read that action, but I don't know if that was true.
I didn't get the sense that there was, personally watching it, first off, talking about her, it is to me like she was the closest thing maybe to a sympathetic female character, ironically, in the because she's not what you would call just overwhelming compassion, but she was actually trying to get these two sailors to help him to get him, you know, back home. And so she's like, she knew that. Now that may have just been that she was sick of having this lodger who was obviously out of his mind in her flop house, but she still sort of seemed to have a little bit of regard. She brings him downstairs, or they bring him downstairs, and then she tries to feed him. Remember, she's got soup there, and she's feeding him soup. And so she does. If there's any female character in this whole movie that is,
it's a sad statement you're about to make.
In blackface, who is, and it's, and ironically, yes, as you pointed out, there's an actual black actor in that scene as the sailor.
The actor Lance is talking about is uncredited in this movie, and as of editing this episode, completely lost to history, seemingly. Sadly, he will also appear in at least two more Hitchcock films, The Ring from 1927, and Champagne from 1928. If you have information on this actor, please leave it in the comments. We'll try to do some deeper research and hopefully have a name, fingers crossed, by the time we do our episode on The Ring. To be continued.
Okay. What I would like to say is I wouldn't go too far or be too generous with the movie around this scene or around reading any intention into the characters, because and I might be misremembering, but I think that after it's over, the sailors are trying to get money for him, right? They open a letter that's addressed to him, or that he has on his you know, in his effects, and they find that he has a nice address in London, and so they're just going back to try to like get some sort of money for returning him home.
Right. They're not doing it out of kindness.
Yeah. So I mean, for a movie that really just traffics in stereotypes and these really one-dimensional characters that are from the get-go, like from the start of the movie, it's like it's pretty classist, over the top, from Mabel all the way to
incredibly sexist characters.
Yeah, it just gets progressively more and more
downhill.
Yeah, the movie goes downhill with the depictions of characters, and I think that that's something that we could apply to everyone in the film. Like, there's no character that is anything more than just
a
prop in this movie. Starting with Roddy,
every character is a stereotype. Yeah. Every character.
Yeah, there's nothing about anything that suggests anything deeper. It's not that type of movie. It's a movie that's like an ideas movie, and the idea is not that interesting. So like the idea, it's a class exploration, but it's not very deep. So when you get to this point, I think we're supposed to read these characters as in the most uncharitable way. Like, I think that's what the movie is trying to give us. And so, yeah, and you know, Roddy is in a stupor in this whole scene. So having said that, like, the story sucks and the plot sucks, and it's not just problematic, it's just like, it's bad art. I mean, it's bad on two levels. It's like, it's incredibly racist. It's incredibly
sexist.
And it's also just not good art, you know, so you don't want to make allowances for it. However, from a technical craft point of view, some of the scenes coming up are some of the most interesting ones in the whole film, which
I agree.
Where you get POV shots of Roddy sort of regaining his consciousness. And as the ship, this steamboat goes from...
Let's just bat a little bit and just say what has happened. So the sailors... After presumably the sailors have taken him on board, they're steaming back to London, right?
Yeah.
You know, hoping to get some sort of reward for Roddy.
But he's in the he's in a, what do you call a room in a boat, like a whatever. He's in a room. He's got a bedroom in this boat, and you know, he occasionally looks out the window, but most of it is him reliving the last indeterminate amount of time. We don't know how long it's been since he was expelled from school. Like, it feels like he lived a lifetime, but in the end of the movie, he's back to playing on the rugby team. So this whole thing has this quality of a fever dream. And while he's remembering everything that happened to him in a series of flashbacks that are just beautifully shot, and these double exposure shots where you have visual cues for each chapter, and the like, you've got the round record, you know, dissolving, cross dissolving into other, like, it's just, it's a beautifully illustrated part of the movie.
The Criterion version, that the tinting was green on it, which is apparently how it should have been, which is the code for tinting is usually seafaring or mysterious scenes, which kind of works on both levels in this. I agree. This is probably one of my favorite parts of the movie, which is similar to Pleasure Garden, where the end was just really great. So I want to point out one of my favorite sequences in this movie. It's when Roddy is laying in his bunk downstairs. We get this great shot of just a random unnamed sailor kind of working by a stairwell. Hitchcock's using the brown tinting still, which is the reality the movie's been presented in. And we see the sailor from behind at the bottom of the stairs, and they're lit like a pathway out just past him. It cuts back to Roddy starting to sit up, and then we get this epic cut to green and the sailor. He does a slow turn reveal, and it's his father. And it is dynamite. Terrifying.
And then that kind of cuts into the tints start to change. The tints go from real world to back to green. We see all the women who have delighted in his fall sitting around the table. Mabel, Julia, Madame Miché, the poetess. They're all counting out and fighting over his money. Presumably it's his money.
Are they playing cards? Like, what? I thought
that's his cash. That's his money on the table. They're all like passing it out. And over their shoulder is Archie. And I don't know why, maybe someone, one of you guys know or someone in the comments, but he's wearing a chef's hat. I don't know why they chose that.
Yeah.
But then as they're fighting, it cuts back to them. Then they're all looking at him. They're pointing and laughing. And now we cut to these great shots of the ship's gears moving.
And then Hitchcock uses another interesting technique with the color where suddenly Roddy is in the green. And now Roddy is part of this delusion and he's completely at rock bottom. And then Hitchcock reuses that shot that we mentioned way at the beginning of the video as not looking good. And whatever you think of it, he reuses it here for Roddy's head, just dancing in place in the same spot. Earlier, it was him running down the football pitch. Here, it's him dancing. And pretty soon when he's on the docks, it'll be him dazed walking back to his parents' house, which, you know, your mileage may vary on whether you like it or not.
Finally, we see his friend Tim with Mabel. We see the shot that starts the whole thing down, basically, from his perspective of Tim and Mabel in the doorway at Ye Olde Bun Shop. And then they slowly walk in and the door closes. I think it's just a great sequence. And it takes what was, you know, don't want to give spoilers on the MacGuffin review, which is coming up, but a bad movie. And it does something interesting.
So it's interesting that you bring up the tinting, because again, the version I watched did not have tinting. And it sounds like there was a lot of, nuance that were a lot of information communicated in that scene that I missed because I didn't have a tinted version.
But the POV shots and the, you know, after the fever breaks and he's returned like to English shores and he's walking. He walks really slowly out of the boat, like up the staircase. And he's seeing double, you know, but it gradually comes more into focus. And you get all these great reverse shots where you see, you know, you get his point of view and then you see him. And like the clarity that's slowly returning to his face is, you know, it's beautifully communicated visually. It's a really interesting thing to watch a movie that has a story that you don't like, but has so many craft and like technical elements that are unquestionably not only innovative and for their time and would be amazing if directors were this creative now, or like a cinematographers were this creative now, because I don't feel like you see things that are, you don't see mundane life filmed in such an inventive way anymore. It was awesome. And there's so many little technical aspects to this movie that were great.
Yeah.
I'll second what Kenny said. And I really love this whole sequence. And then you get back to home. And you brought this up, Kenny, and he's the figure that looms over the whole thing is the father and the reconciliation that happens, which is kind of abrupt and not doesn't need to be anything more than abrupt, I guess. But the father saying, I know everything, I know the truth. And they very quickly reconcile. And the whole thing just feels like a return to, not only is the whole thing a return to normal, but you feel like nothing was gained. And this is getting to where the story is really, to me, like the plot of this movie is just pretty dumb. It feels like a PSA for rich kids. Like it's
away from the ladies.
Yeah.
What's that?
Stay away from the
stay away from the ladies.
from the wanton Bohemian women, because they will be your ruin. Or just really any woman.
Any woman. Old, young,
rich. Your mom. Your mom's cool. You can hang out with your mom, but you know, don't expect your mom to have your back when your dad throws you out, because clearly she didn't. You know, she had no say in
it's
that.
It's weird
situation.
That this is co-written by a you know, his writing partner's a woman.
Hey, yeah. bad writers are come of every stripe and description.
It is definitely, you know, the four movies, all of them have a very strong streak of misogyny in them, of the first four that we've seen. Well, one, three that we've seen plus the one that we haven't seen, but you know, we've analyzed the story, but this one certainly has really no sympathetic female characters at all. I mean, other than what I view as mildly sympathetic portrayal, which, you know, was really the woman who's running the flophouse. But
sympathetic is the wrong word, though, because it doesn't matter whether you feel sympathy or whether you like the characters. It's like, are they any good? Is there anything interesting about any of these characters? And I would say there's nothing interesting about any character in this movie. They're all kind of like cardboard cutouts. None of them learn it. Roddy doesn't learn anything.
Going back to the final scene too, where you definitely you're 100% correct. There is no, it is almost surreal how he comes back to, he's on the rugby team again, and playing with the old boys. And I'm like, how old is he now? 22? Do they let 22-year-olds play?
There's no indication of how much time it could have been. The whole thing could have been like, you know, the Grand Tour. He was just taking a gap year to go explore France and, like, you know, have adventures. But there wasn't.
Well, he got married. I mean, it's so weird. Like when he cycles back to that, it just brings home to my mind. It brought home just how absurd the whole thing was. You know, how absurd the story is.
Maybe that's why the fever dream part of the movie was the best. Well, at least Kenny and my opinion, the best part of the movie, because the whole movie was sort of a fever dream. Like that was sort of a microcosm of the story. It's like these kind of irrational and fantastical fears that someone of his class would have about all the perils of mixing with like the lower classes. And in the end, he's exactly where he started, like in a dream. He just kind of wakes up and his relationship with his father is intact. And, you know, the conflict between the father and son and the reconciliation between the father and son is meant to be the sort of conclusion of the movie. But it doesn't, I was wondering about this, is like, why didn't it have any force? And I think it was because there wasn't any real conflict playing out between them. The conflict between Roddy, it was with the world. You know, I mean, they had a fight. He was he exiled himself, but it wasn't anything his father did or anything really that he did. It was these injustices that were visited upon him that only happened because he mingled outside of his class, you know, and that's kind of where the movie leaves you. It's like, I don't know. It just felt like a whole bunch of sort of fever dream fears of what could happen to someone with wealth if they ended up on the wrong side. And honestly, this is probably something that was happening a lot in the interwar period in England, you know, where like fortunes were being lost and, you know, this great depression, I guess the depression didn't happen until a couple of years later. I didn't feel like there was too much redeeming in like any of the story, you know, it was really just completely in the technical elements, which I thought were overall fantastic. And I thought this was the best crafted movie that we've watched so far.
All right, guys, for those who just skipped ahead in the video and all of our great discussion is now lost to you, you just want the MacGuffin review. I get it. You just, you know, you can't. This is what you came for. So I'm going to lead us off. So I watched this movie twice, and my opinion shifted only slightly on the second viewing. There's things I like. There are things I definitely did not like. Ivor Novello has really kind of great range compared to his turn in The Lodger. where he was playing this very theatrical role. And it was great seeing him do something different here. I personally was, I don't know how these guys feel, but I was rooting for him to get his act together. He kind of had this Candide quality of being a little bit on the dumb side and constantly falling for all the pitfalls of life. Norman McKinnell, as his father, is suitably menacing. Some of the looks over the shoulder into the camera will stay with me. They're really great. Hitchcock has some really great tricks that I liked. The delirium sequence was my favorite part of the film. It was a relatively short part of a very long film. Probably recommend Lodger and Pleasure Garden definitely over this one. But if you liked Ivor Novello in The Lodger, you should probably watch this just to give him another turn. My negatives of this movie were I didn't like the entire second act with the marriage sequence was very boring, and I could see a lot of people turning the movie off at that point. A wealthy actress marries him for money and leaves him when she runs him dry. We never see why he falls in love with her. We're left to guess it's because she's super sexy in the flimsy dresses that she's wearing, and that's it. There's weird comedy in this movie. I'm not sure why it was left in. I hated the stunt double from Spaceballs. I hated the blackface. I hated the lack of characterization in just about everybody. It's very hard for me to believe that this was a hit play because the plot is just so thin and goes nowhere. I'd be interested in seeing a staging of the play, but I would feel bad for whatever company decided to put it on. You should probably just do a version of The Lodger. It's a better movie. The soundtrack was fine. No complaints. The film looked good. The restoration was impressive. I am giving this movie 2 MacGuffins. I was considering going a little bit higher, 2.5, but I had to definitely knock some off for the blackface. That's just ridiculous. 1 full MacGuffin is for Ivor Novello. I'm going to miss seeing him in these movies. I think he's a surprise of the silent era that if they had cast someone else in this role, I might have a very different opinion of this movie and not be able to recommend it. So that's where I land.
Well, that was a very reasoned and thoughtful and exhaustive kind of breakdown. So I'm going to give you a much less thought through review. I thought that this movie had so many impressive technical elements that it actually pushed me to enjoying it. But I didn't really like the story. I thought the actors, a handful of them were really good. I think Ivor Novello, as Kenny said, sold this, even if he was a little too old to play the part of a kid in school, in pre-college. So I didn't like this movie. And yet I loved it technically. I liked the camera work. I thought there was a lot in it that was just so interesting to look at and so visually interesting and like things you don't see anymore. I loved the visual storytelling was fantastic. So I'd give it 2 because it was a bad movie, but it was sort of well crafted. That's it.
Whenever any of these movies we've watched so far of Hitchcock, to me are always fascinating from a historical perspective. So I always have to give it maybe a half a MacGuffin just for the fascinating, you know, I don't know. I'm interested in history and it's always fascinating to sort of see this window back into history. But it is an atrociously bad story. It was an irredeemably bad story, I feel like. And it was also irredeemably bad characters with no, redemptive qualities. It was like, incredibly misogynistic, racist as we pointed out, but I mean, not necessarily outside, that's not necessarily, outside the, that's obviously normal for that age. Unfortunately, that's just kind of like depressingly normal standard for that period. So I don't knock it necessarily for that. Trying to, couch it within the period that it was created. But even still, it was just a terrible story. And it was Ivor Novello was definitely, you know, he's fascinating to watch. To think that he wrote this tripe, though, it kind of like, it, you know, as you said, I'm disappointed with him because if it had just been him acting in it, my opinion of Ivor Novello would probably be higher. But anybody who would write such a dreck, you know, I can't help but you know, it knocks my esteem of him down a notch. So I do feel like, yes, there was a lot of inventive camera work, and there were a few moments where you can see kind of the artistry, and there was the clever moment that I described earlier where it's sort of like a double, I can't even think of what term to use for it, but basically where he's, in the tuxedo, but then you see he's a waiter, but then it pulls back again and you see that he's actually in a theater production. So there were little moments like that that were interesting, but overall, it was the one I liked the least of what we watched so far. So I would give it 1.5 MacGuffins.
I would also mention to our people at home that Ivor Novello, the writing we are all familiar with, that is his most famous work, is Me, Tarzan, You, Jane. So the quality of his writing might be suspect.
But there was that immortal line.
Yes.
It will be forever remembered for.
Next time on Presenting Alfred Hitchcock, we will be reviewing Hitchcock's fifth movie, Easy Virtue, from 1927. The good news is this movie is readily available on YouTube, online, your grocery bins as part of comprehensive 20 movie disc sets. The bad news is these are all bootlegs and horrible copies of this movie.
Oh.
It is one of only two movies that the BFI restored in 2012 that have not been released properly yet. So if you live in America, just do your best. Try to watch this movie. It won't be the best version. However, I did manage to pick up a region-free DVD player, and there actually is one decent version available. It's from France. The title of the movie there is Le passé ne meurt pas. I really hope I didn't butcher that. But it means the past does not die. It's an elephant release. Here's what the DVD looks like if you really want to follow along on an unlimited budget.
There is a rumor that Criterion Collection might be putting out a Pleasure Garden Blu-ray DVD, which would have Easy Virtue theoretically as a backup, similar to Downhill was on The Lodger. That's not known right now. It would be dope. And if that happens, maybe we'll re-review Easy Virtue later, because everything I've seen about it is we are in for something. But that's your homework and ours. Goodbye. How do we end these things?
I don't know. I think you just stop the record button.
We just kind of cut off in the middle of something?
Mid-sentence.
So we'll see you all next time.
I like that one.
Yeah, that's good.
Adios, muchachos.
To deprecate the American audience, or the world audience for that matter, but the phrase I use is moronic logic.